Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signe Darpinian, co-author of No Way, a teen's guide to positive body image, food, and emotional wisdom. Today, we will be talking about the barriers to physical and mental health in sport, body image in sport culture, and the need to be perfect in athletes, and how to navigate that in a more balanced way. Joining us for this conversation is the spokesperson in the media for input on relevant mental health topics for athletes, such as eating disorders, anxiety, and performance improvement, Dr. Riley Nichols. Dr. Nichols is a counseling and sports psychologist who specializes in treating athletes with eating disorders. He is the director of the Victory Program, the nation's only residential eating disorder treatment facility for athletes, at McCollum Place in St. Louis, Missouri. Dr. Nichols has an MS in sports psychology, an MS in counseling psychology, and a PhD in counseling psychology. He speaks regularly to athletes, coaches, and sports medicine personnel about disordered eating and unbalanced exercise in sport. He maintains a private practice in St. Louis, where he primarily works with athletes addressing both clinical and performance concerns. In addition to competing in endurance sports for over 15 years now, Dr. Nichols is a running coach and a USA triathlon coach. Riley, thank you for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me, Signe.
So Riley, as a sports psychologist, you know an athlete's desire to be driven, confident, and successful. And as you say, in order to live these values, physical and mental health must be at the foundation. What are common barriers you see to a strong foundation here?
There's a multitude of barriers that can disrupt that foundation. I think about sport performance and physical and psychological health as being inextricably linked. Unfortunately, though, too often physical and mental health are neglected at times in lieu of achieving a high sport performance. And individuals who play sport are people first and foremost, and athletes very secondary. And I believe that sport performance is a byproduct of many factors, including caring for oneself physically, psychologically, spiritually, in a holistic manner. Most athletes are quite aware of just the physical demands in terms of training their bodies in preparation for sport, but there's many other factors that have been shown to kind of directly influence sport performance. One of the factors in that foundation that is so vital for just overall health, much less sport performance, that I'm passionate about is relative energy deficiency in sport. And essentially, athletes have a very high energy needs. And when those energy needs are not supported nutritionally, there can be an energy deficit. And REDS is relative energy deficiency in sport was constructed by individuals from the International Olympic Committee about 5 years ago or so. This kind of paradigm is, I think, quite helpful in reminding us all that all systems of the body are linked together and work in unison and can affect one another. And when an individual is in a state of energy deficiency, that not only impacts cardiac functioning potentially, but also psychological functioning, endocrine functioning, bone health, and a variety of other systems in the body, which for athletes, oftentimes, inevitably, it will impact performance and of course will impact one's health as well. So just in thinking about foundational attributes or foundational factors tied to sport performance, I think of many things, but REDS is certainly one primary reason or barrier that can be disrupted in that capacity.
Riley, when you mention relative energy deficiency in sport, and as you said, it's called REDS, can you give us an example of what that might look like?
In the short term, an athlete can unintentionally or intentionally, oftentimes it's unintentional in nature, not meet their energy needs. And athletes have very high energy needs. In the short term, that can have implications from an energy standpoint, from a focus and concentration standpoint, from an endurance standpoint. And I think that the body, I'm struck by just how tremendously resilient the body and brain are to function even in a state of impairment. And REDS really is more pronounced with the cumulative effects of being in a persistent state of energy deficiency. So an athlete who doesn't meet their energy needs for a day or two might not notice too much of a disruption just in their quality of life, their functioning. An athlete who is in a prolonged state of energy deficiency over a sustained period of time, those implications are much more pronounced. And so to answer your question, an individual might notice just in terms of changes in mood. So it might become more anxious or depressed, or might have OCD symptoms kind of arise. And there's like oftentimes a connectedness interpersonally as well, or there's almost a greater difficulty kind of engaging in relationships as one might in a state of energy balance. Two, not always, but cardiovascular functioning can be impacted as well in a prolonged state of energy deficiency, especially amongst athletes. And that is often typified by a low heart rate, and we call bradycardia, is a low heart rate, which for many athletes in thinking about having a low heart rate, that's oftentimes quite desirable because it might indicate a high level of fitness. And that is kind of one of the myths that providers kind of in our field here really try to identify, because in a state of energy balance, and if an athlete has a low heart rate, that is not worrisome or problematic. However, in a state of energy deficiency and having symptoms that are described by REDS, that oftentimes your body doesn't have enough available energy to sustain just a normal heart rate. And so it can mask itself as being an athlete's heart or a fit heart, but it can actually be a quite compromised heart as well, and can just not have enough available energy to beat normally as it needs to and should.
Riley, I learned from you that when an athlete has relative energy deficiency in sport, that in this case might be a sick heart, can be misinterpreted for a fit heart.
That's very correct. And you're spot on in that, Signa. And I think that poses some challenges just for athletes, for sport personnel, and for providers to really identify the genesis and what is contributing to a low heart rate. Right? It can sometimes mask itself as an athlete's heart, but in reality can be a sick heart, and that really is just poses some notable risks, but also warrants just targeted treatment to remedy this.
So Riley, you say that weight is one of about 40 factors in sport performance, yet it seems to get the most emphasis. Why is this problematic?
This belief is problematic because for some athletes, elevating weight to a disproportionate place increases the vulnerability to engage in unwholesome thoughts and behaviors, more specifically, susceptibility for disordered eating or an eating disorder. The overemphasis on weight specific to athletic performance can be reinforced when an athlete or an athlete's teammate experiences performance improvements after changes in weight occur, which can further reinforce the perceived importance of weight on athletic performance. This notion is also problematic, I think, because sports science research over the past few decades or so has shown there are a multitude of factors that have been directly linked to impact athletic performance that are being minimized and neglected in lieu of weight. Factors such as sleep, mental toughness, concentration, confidence, reaction time, rest, coordination, commitment, and coachability are just some of those factors. Our bodies perform optimally and are more apt to sustain a high consistent level of performance when both physically, physiologically, and psychologically healthy. Specific to weight, our bodies and brain optimally function at a weight that is individualized and most appropriate for our unique genetic makeup, rather than attempting to modify weight to fit a perceived ideal.
And Riley, if an individual, let's say, maybe has disordered eating or an eating disorder, and as a result, there's negative body image there, I'm assuming that can impede performance.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think participating and competing in sport requires just tremendous demands from your body, just physically, but also too cognitively as well. And I think if there is an increase in body dissatisfaction or body image distress, that really just diverts needed resources away from the demands inherent just in sport. And I think when you're preoccupied, even at a low level, with your body or food or weight, of course, how could it not at some level really impede sport performance and just sport enjoyment too? I'm a big believer that our bodies perform optimally when they are at a weight and a body composition that is ideal for our genetic makeup. And sometimes that fits this sport body stereotype that exists in certain sports in terms of physique or size or shape. And then sometimes that your genetic makeup does not. And I think oftentimes when there is a perception that our weight, shape, size, body composition does not fit or is not ideal for our a particular sport, sometimes there can be efforts made to really change and transform that in a way that really just disallows the brain and body to function optimally as well. And so I do think that sensitivity in these areas by parents, by coaches, of course, by athletes and whatnot, really needs to be had, because not all athletes are, of course, vulnerable in these areas to struggle. But however, there are quite a few athletes who are, and messaging that is direct or implied can really be a catalyst for an athlete to really struggle in these ways in quite unwholesome behaviors as well.
Well, and Riley, I like the way you speak about body image, because you use a body image continuum or a body image spectrum. And when I've heard you talk before, let's say like at one end of the continuum, if I remember it correctly, might be body hatred, then there's body tolerance, body acceptance, and body love. What I like about your body image spectrum is that, you know, the whole love your body idea might feel inaccessible to someone who's starting from a place of not liking it.
I think sometimes the messaging that, you know, society gives or those eating disorder treatment providers sometimes can give is to love your body. And of course, that's ideal.
Sure.
And that would be lovely if everybody could love their bodies. I think most individuals that I work with, unfortunately, are not at that place. And so that seems very foreign. That seems like it's another planet. And it's hard to wrap your mind around. So I think of, rather than more of a categorical, I either love my body or I do not, I think on a continuum, as you mentioned. And I do think potentially an individual who might not love their bodies might be able to, can you accept your body? You might not love it. And that opens a dialogue there for, can you accept something that you don't love? And some individuals can, and sometimes that's quite challenging or not possible for others. And then further on that continuum is this tolerance, right? Can you tolerate your body that you have a hard time accepting and do not love, right? And again, that might feel more accessible and feel more reachable for some athletes and others, not so much. And then I think on the other end of the continuum, Dr. Jen Gaudiani, who is extremely knowledgeable medical doctor in the eating disorder world, uses the term caretake. And I really like that term. And I think that's oftentimes what we are asking individuals in our care to do, to caretake for themselves and caretake for their bodies. And I think that seems more accessible and achievable in a multitude of ways. If that's internal dialogue, if that's the tone of voice that you speak to yourself in, that might be caretaking for yourself, might be just taking an extra rest day when your body is speaking to you and maybe that is needed, maybe not wanted or planned, but maybe needed. And so I oftentimes kind of launch from that angle and really kind of dialogue with individuals about caretaking for themselves holistically, but specifically in response to maybe some notable body image distress or body dissatisfaction that they have as well.
Caretaking your body, would an example be treating your body well, even when you're not liking it?
That's exactly what it is. And
okay.
It makes me think of when I was younger, I had a next door neighbor who had a dog, and I love dogs and I'm a dog person. But I really did not like this dog too much. It was a poodle. It was a big poodle that kept jumping up on me every time I would get near it. But I was about 10 or 12 years old, highly motivated. I love baseball cards. And so watching this dog while my neighbors were away on vacation was something that I did. And I certainly did not love this dog. I had a hard time tolerating this dog and certainly kind of accepting that, okay, this is just how this dog is wired, but I could commit to caretake for it. And that meant giving it food, water, t- taking it for walks, picking up after it as well. And so I think I think about, you know, caretaking for ourselves in a very similar manner, in that I do believe that by caretaking for yourself in a loving manner, even though you do not feel loving towards yourself, doing so consistently over time will allow your heart and beliefs about yourself to change. However, if you feel unloving towards yourself and or have some type of hatred towards yourself, and your behaviors parallel that and support that feeling, and you behave towards yourself in an unloving manner, those feelings are most likely to stay quite stuck and stubborn, and will take longer to potentially shift and change.
How do you navigate the need to be perfect in athletes?
Yes, that is quite multifaceted and challenging to answer simplistically, but I will try. I think if an athlete specifically has this disposition, kind of this perfectionistic disposition, I'm always curious in terms of wanting to get a good understanding about the function behind just the inherent need to be perfect, as I certainly don't want to make any inferences as to what is behind this, but it will also help me to gain awareness as to what is driving this disposition. Oftentimes, this orientation, this perfectionism, can be an attempt to insulate oneself from the feelings of inadequacy, shame, and judgment that can sometimes result from not meeting exceedingly high expectations or some standard of performance. Sometimes the need to be perfect can be tied or related to identity or potentially fear. And I think that fear oftentimes drives the bus in a lot of ways in life. So for example, it could be a fear of failure or actually a fear of success too. I know several athletes in my current caseload, they perform well at an early season meet. Right? That maybe was not expected or anticipated, or they perform better than they thought they would. And that actually evokes this fear response as though, oh my goodness, I need to not only sustain this level of performance throughout the rest of the year, but I need to improve. And that is quite crushing, I think, for an individual who is wired kind of in this nature with the perfectionism. And I think it's challenging because perfectionism is not, I think sometimes there's this notion whereby when athletes specifically, you know, we're talking about perfectionism, they might interpret it that, I'm just really driven, motivated, committed, and I don't want to change that. And I would argue, absolutely, no, those are strengths that we kind of want to nurture and not strip away. However, I do think with perfectionism oftentimes comes this just inherent inability to tolerate mistakes, to tolerate mistakes in a multitude of capacities, and just this inability to be patient and compassionate with themselves. And I think that's really challenging. And you think about in the sport context, there might be some performance slumps or some games where, you know, you're not performing to your expectations or just even your abilities. And you can see where if you have this response, there is almost like a withholding or inability to be compassionate with yourself in the midst of struggle. Most perfectionists that I know, oftentimes they have an inherent response to crank the effort dial and to try harder to remedy maybe a situation or outcome that is not desirable or favorable. And if the outcome isn't remedied, you can see where this situation can really spin someone in the ground and lead to increased frustration and distress.
Do you mean that cranking the dial then sort of interferes with their ability to learn from the perceived mistake?
Absolutely. No, I do think it does, because I think there's this notion where if I put in more effort, an outcome would be more favorable. And that seems to make logical sense. And I think sometimes in life that follows suit in studying for a test or a grade in a class or whatnot too. Sometimes in sport, trying harder per se actually like pulls you further away from just allowing your talents organically to take over and your performance to kind of stabilize.
Okay.
I also had a, it makes me think of a rower that I am currently working with, and she fits kind of this perfectionistic kind of disposition to a T. And she told me, it's easier not to give myself a chance than to try really hard and fail.
Oh.
And I heard her say that, and I reflected it back to her because I just wanted to make sure I heard her say that correctly. And I said, wait a second, it's easier not to give yourself a chance than to try really hard and fail. Can you tell me about that? And she said, yeah, because if I try really hard and fail, then it's just entirely on me, right? And that's just, I can't even stand that, because then it's just, I'm just inept and inadequate in this regard in my rowing. But if I perceive that I could try harder, then that's a kind of a controllable variable that I could really pour my efforts and mind into.
I see. So with that client as an example, how do you treat the perfectionism?
Yeah, this is just kind of a long-standing disposition that is certainly not going to be something to that will be remedied quickly. So I do think kind of an area that I really try and enhance or cultivate is this ability to be curious. And I don't know about you, Signa, but I admire individuals and people that I know who are just really curious about life, about information, about themselves, right? And I oftentimes think that in the context of perfectionism, there is oftentimes an absence of curiosity. And there is this inherent, almost reflexive judgment and criticism that is levied upon oneself, an outcome that shuts down curiosity entirely. I personally don't think curiosity can coexist with such judgment and criticism. So I think kind of really cultivating curiosity, it really is kind of more of this growth mindset where you can kind of learn and think about things differently or different perspectives or take just different approaches to certain tasks that you're trying to engage in.
So what would the curiosity look like as an example, you know, with an athlete you're working with? How might you reframe it with curiosity?
Yeah, so curiosity can be something like, let's say a basketball player had a really disappointing or poor first half, right? And starting the second half of the game, and maybe the curiosity can be, man, I'm still thinking about those two wide open shots that I missed in the first quarter. And curiosity can be like, I wonder why that's just dominating my thoughts right now. I wonder if I can really deliberately and intentionally redirect my focus to what I'm doing right now and coming out of this timeout and can be very present. I wonder if my focus will kind of shift and I can kind of release those mistakes, you know, a bit more and revisit them maybe after the game. Curiosity can also be something to the effect of, before a game or performance, my heart's being really fast and I'm really anxious. I'm kind of surprised. I really don't get anxious oftentimes. I wonder, you know, if I really engage in some breathing exercises that I've done in the past right now, I wonder if that would kind of decrease my heart rate and help me focus and concentrate a little bit better. And so I wonder if I kind of go through a few cycles of these breathing exercises, if that will be helpful. And so that's kind of a lens where you're validating your internal experiences, your somatic experiences and cognitive and emotional experiences, but you're also too flexible and curious about them. As doing so will inform you in a multitude of different ways, as opposed to if that curiosity was absent or lacking.
I can only imagine the many reasons that an athlete might have to take a break from their sport, maybe due to illness, and now we have COVID, injury, or maybe recovery from an eating disorder. What's your best advice to guide them through having to take a break?
I think kind of the first approach is to really try to allow space and some time to essentially mourn the temporary or sometimes even permanent loss of sport, whether it's, like you said, due to injury or season being canceled because of COVID or eating disorder treatment. Because I think that is just a really impactful experience. It is quite challenging to navigate. I had an experience personally just with injury, shoulder injury in baseball, and that was really just challenging. But I think that as a provider, even as a parent, I do think there's sometimes a need to want to like fix it and to help them pull through this space quickly and really expedite that. But I think that's a missed opportunity and can really be disconnected from an athlete's current state to essentially mourn this loss of sport, even if it's for a season or sometimes, and similar to mourning the loss of a human being. And you think about the Kubler-Ross, the stages of grief. There are a lot of the psychology of injury research in sports specifically, athletes experience a somewhat similar experience. They go through somewhat stages, for lack of a better term, of the mourning process that can be embodied by stages of sadness or depression, bargaining, denial, anger, and then ideally acceptance at some point. And so I do think kind of allowing that space to happen organically is really helpful, first and foremost. And I think sometimes that takes more time than we would like, but I think is needed. I think secondly, oftentimes individuals who are pulled from sport, maybe not by their own volition, if it's an injury or otherwise, I think gentleness and compassion is just really needed. And it's quite discouraging. Sometimes it's physically really painful if you're going through an injury or surgery or rehab. And there's a lot of uncertainty that comes with it too, just with any break in sport. Uncertainty about the future, about potentially regaining athletic performance once you are able to resume sport participation. And so I do think there's just a need to be gentle and quite compassionate towards yourself. And then I think it's a time too, I think in any pause or break in competition or involvement in sport, it's a wonderful time to kind of rediscover your why. Why do I love this sport? Why am I playing?
Ooh, I like that.
And I know that might seem like a very basic question, but I think it's foundational. Because if you aren't anchored into your why, your motivation, your primary reason for exerting a lot of effort, energy, and time dedicated towards your sport, that's going to be quite challenging. And I've worked with a lot of athletes over the years in a state of injury or eating disorder treatment. They maybe come to the realization for the first time, sometimes ever, that I once really enjoyed and loved my sport and playing. And if I'm honest, recently and for a while, it hasn't really felt the same. And kind of helps them reexamine their relationship with their sport as well. And is this a want, or just feel like as though I need to continue competing or continue in my sport? And I think that is an important process as well. And then lastly, I do think in any time when there is a temporary or permanent pause in sport participation or competition, I think just connection with others is so vital. There's a lot of injury support groups for athletes that I think are so valuable. Think about yourself. And if you have a sickness or an ailment or surgery, I think talking to someone else kind of who has kind of gone through something similar can actually be very healing and comforting too. So I think sometimes, and especially athletes who are injured, it can be a very isolating experience because you're pulled from your teammates who you oftentimes spend a lot of time with just at practice and traveling or eating and whatnot. And it can be isolating because sometimes you're, in the training room or doing your rehab exercises or in treatment. And so that isolation is very challenging to kind of navigate. And so I think finding ways to stay connected to those people who are supportive in your life, but especially in your sport community is just vital.
I love how you're talking about grief in a more expansive way, because I do think that we're used to thinking about grief when we lose a loved one, but not thinking about loss of sport as you've known it. And I really like the idea of using it as an opportunity to get anchored in your why. One of the many things that people worry about when they are taking a pause, assuming that it's something that they are going to be able to get back to, I know that people worry about losing their fitness.
Yeah, that's a valid concern for a lot of athletes. And I do think that's, again, where kind of the fear creeps in and where fear is very active. And a lot of the athletes that I work with their bodies are well primed to respond when the time comes, when they resume training or resume engagement in their sport, well primed to kind of respond to the training demands placed on it. That is oftentimes their fitness is oftentimes the easiest thing to kind of return.
Oh, okay.
However, for most athletes, that's the biggest concern, right? So I do think it's important to kind of just acknowledge that fear is very present and normalize it. Look, yeah, we're making some changes here, or this injury occurred, and we don't know how, you know, you don't have absolute certainty with how, you know, your foot's going to respond once you, you know, start back biking. I think kind of normalizing it, recognizing where fear might be present, but also to taking a strengths-based approach and reflecting, man, everything that I know about you, you're so extremely dedicated and motivated and committed, and I have no doubt you're going to stick with the rehab protocol, right?
That
your,
right,
you know, your physical therapist has given you. You're gonna do what coach asks you, and so kind of I think soothing in that sense I think is really important and needed. But that's kind of unavoidable, I think, for most athletes to have those concerns about performance after some time off. And I think it's important to really address those, because those can be fluid and change and shift and intensify depending on kind of what's going on, you know, week to week even. So,
okay. And would you take the same approach, the mourning and the grief and kind of going through those stages of grief naturally for an athlete that's going from competitive sport? So say, you know, for example, a competitive dancer that's used to 5 hours a day of training is now going on to the teaching credential program, as an example, and there isn't the time. Mm-hmm. Would it be the same approach?
Yeah, more or less. I would agree with okay. that. I think that, you know, transitions in life are just inevitable. And sometimes those are planned and sometimes those are unexpected. And I think in thinking about transitioning from sport, you know, oftentimes, whether it's playing in college and having kind of a competitive sport in that regard kind of end and transitioning to grad school or a career is pretty common, but quite disruptive and challenging for a lot of athletes to kind of navigate. I do think that this kind of speaks to more of an identity lens that it really resonates with me in terms of how we think about ourselves and see ourselves and where we derive our value and worth. And I think for many athletes who devote an immense amount of time, effort, and energy into sport, unfortunately view themselves in a very limited, unidimensional construct as an athlete. And of course, there's far more dimensions and constructs that make them unique and human, of course. But most salient is how they, you know, an athlete kind of views and senses himself. So a transition can be, well, if I'm not doing and producing in these ways on the athletic field or in competition, then now what? Like, where, how am I of value? And so I think this identity and this transition in identity in terms of roles of life, if that's, you know, from a student to, you know, a professional in the working field, can be really challenging. But I think it speaks to that and trying to broaden kind of sense of self and identity in a way. And I think when it comes to this, body and physique, I think some athletes struggle with that too, with just changes that can inherently occur when there's, you know, decreased time spent in training and preparing for sport. And I think just changes in life, whether that's transitioning to motherhood, mm-hmm. right? That a lot of women experience. I would argue that your physique that is changing and your body that changes really can serve to really honor a new season of life for you. And I think that our bodies certainly tell a story, but I think that potentially, like in a different season of life, like my involvement in even just being active looked very different than in this season of life where I just don't have the right time or it doesn't fit. And that's where I think it's a really important question for individuals who struggle with really unwholesome clinging to fitness or even exercise is, do you structure your life around exercise or training for your sport? Or do you structure exercise and training for your sport around life? And I think that's an important kind of question that really is indicative and illustrative of the place that holds in your heart and your mind.
I love that definition. And what I remember learning from the Eating Disorder in Sport conference that you put on with the Victory Program, that, yeah, one of the losses in this transition identity is loss of body as you've known it.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, in the question that you posed with the competitive dancer, I think that's, you know, the training required to be a competitive dancer, a competitive athlete is significant, is likely targeted to improve technique and stamina. However, once a season of life changes, competition in dance or sport is not a driving force behind the training required for your sport or dance. The question, I think, then needs to be, what type of movement just sounds fun and will bring me joy?
Yeah.
And that kind of aligns more with the intuitive movement, which I think is so vital for lifelong involvement in balanced and wholesome fitness or exercise as well.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you, Riley. Well, Riley, in sport, performance-based cultures where there's this great emphasis placed on earning medals and winning, sometimes at the expense of athletes' well-being, I want to thank you for dedicating your life's work to reshaping sport culture and for shining your light on the physical and mental health needs of athletes.
Thanks so much, Cigna. It was an honor to chat with you here, and I appreciate all your efforts and the work that you are doing on a daily basis.
How can our listeners find you?
Yeah, they can contact me through my website. It's Mind Body Endurance, three words. Happy to respond through there. I think there's a contact page, Riley.Nichols, N-I-C-K-O-L-S, at Mind Body Endurance is my email. I'm happy to respond if there's a question or just comment or a thought that you might have.
Riley, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show today.
Cigna, thanks so much for having me. It was a lot of fun talking with you, and I appreciate all that you're doing.
Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. And a reminder that you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And feel free to contact me at www.cignadarpinian.com.